This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're getting well, well, well with the team from Thorn Harbour Health.
The Digital Sexual Health or Sex Tech Research Project is focused on better understanding how LGBTQ+ people think about sex tech and how it can advance LGBTQ+ people's sexual health by supporting safety, pleasure, and well-being. To learn more about the project, we're joined now by Professor Kath Aubrey from the Swinburne University of Technology. Thank you so much for joining us on the show, Kath. I guess to begin with, can you tell us a bit about your background in research and how the project came about?
Yeah, sure. I had done some work in the past looking at sexting and then at looking at dating apps, and that got me interested in the kind of everyday cultures of sharing sexual data. And I also had a background looking at sexual health and working with sexual health organisations more from a media and communication and cultural perspective. And so a colleague in Sweden, Jenny Sunden, suggested we get some funding from a Swedish organisation to do some comparative Australian-Swedish research. And Dr. Zara Stardust joined us on that project from Queensland University of Technology. And Zara had been leading some work on sex tech in the public interest. And we had run a sex tech hackathon in online during lockdown in 2021. So it was a convergence of lots of really interesting research projects and interests.
You mentioned in that sort of sexting and dating apps, and I mean, a hackathon I imagine would be in part maybe reprogramming, maybe some sex toys or something along that. For the purposes of this research project, I guess, how did you define sex tech?
Yeah, sex tech is a very broad church. It is a huge emerging market globally, and it refers to everything from a kind of Wi-Fi enabled vibrator, which is, you know, the first thing a lot of people think about, to AI chatbots that might flirt with you or might give you sexual health information. It also includes non-digital technologies. So when we think about sex tech, we might think about things like packers and binders, because they are a sexual technology. And in a kind of biomedical sense, you could think about things like PrEP and PEP as sex tech too. So it's quite a broad space. There is actually a history of thinking about condoms as sex tech, and sex dolls and dildos and kind of non-animated technologies as well. So it is quite broad, and we're interested in all of those aspects of sex tech, even though obviously, as I said, I started from a kind of digital and data studies perspective.
So the research project itself, how has that research been conducted? How do you, I guess, better understand how people think about sex tech? I imagine it's a lot of surveying and qualitative and quantitative data gathering.
Yeah, ours is purely qualitative at this stage. So it's and it's quite focused on LGBTQ+ communities. There has been some work done on sex tech broadly in the past, which is much more population focused and sometimes quite market focused. We're really interested in, I guess, a kind of queerer perspective on sex tech and the quality of people's experiences. So we've been conducting interviews in Australia and in Sweden with sex tech users, and also with people who you might call founders of sex tech companies, but also retailers too. So people who sell tech and toys as part of either a kind of business that does more than that, or in a kind of classic, you know, sex shop model.
Provided I imagine there's a confidentiality sort of thought here, but how do you find sex tech users? I think with businesses, with industry, it's very easy to be able to reach out to businesses and go, hey, we want to be able to ask about your product and the customers, and, you know, there's a lot there. But how do you find sex tech users that are comfortable speaking about this stuff?
Yeah, it's especially tricky now because, as we know, there's so much kind of transphobic, homophobic, misogynist garbage online. It used to be quite easy to put a shout out on the platform formerly known as Twitter and say, hey, do you use sex tech? Would you like to do an interview? We do not use that platform anymore because it's unmoderated and we would say unsafe. So it was quite a tricky process recruiting. We asked people to share the call out in group chats. We asked people to share it on their Discord server. We asked people to, in closed moderated groups to share. So it was mostly through queer social groups. And they may or may not have been sexuality focused groups, but they were known to be queer friendly generally. And then, you know, the technique of just saying, you know, if you have any friends you think might be interested, please pass it along.
I want to come back a little bit later on to, I guess, the digital literacy, because you mentioned Discord there. And so people would have potentially higher digital literacy than in other circles. And that's certainly something that we think about within our work at Thorn Harbor Health around sexual health literacy. I'll come back to that. I guess we spoke a little bit about the research being entirely qualitative so far. What have been some of the key preliminary findings to come from this research?
It's been really interesting. So there's a... a big kind of marketing push in the field of sexuality generally, and I say marketing because, you know, sexologists and counsellors also market themselves and promote their services. And, you know, health promotion organisations do marketing too in terms of social marketing. But there's been classically a bit of a push to optimise or improve your sexual experience as a means, and that's like the invitation, like, do you want better, harder, longer lasting sex? You know, those kinds of ads.
The billboards that were up around Australia like 20 years ago, I think.
Yeah, the erectile dysfunction billboards from years ago, but also the kind of advice that you might get in a magazine like, you know, Cosmopolitan or Dolly or, you know, Smash Hits or whatever. What, Smash Hits didn't have sex advice, but, you know, it's often assumed that what people want to know about sex is how to have better orgasms, more orgasms, longer orgasms, be hornier, be better in some way. And what was really surprising for us in the findings was that the queer tech users and also the people who were making the tech who identified as queer talked about being curious or exploring sexuality or exploring your body. And it was a really non-linear process that wasn't about kind of optimization and improvement, but about having different kinds of experiences. Sometimes that was about like gender exploration or gender affirmation. And relearning about your body, for example, after gender affirmation surgery or after, you know, taking hormones for a certain length of time and experiencing your sexuality differently. But even people who were cis were talking about wanting to explore what their body could do in different ways, and like it being a kind of open-ended question: what can my body do with this toy? What can my body do with that toy? What can I do? And it's not, I wouldn't say it's the case that heterosexual people don't think about their bodies that way, but I think it's a heteronormative narrative that we can somehow, you know, optimize or perfect our body or our experience, and there will be a point at which the progress is over and we're done. You know, we've perfected it. And I think there's a kind of sense in queer community that stuff's like always messy and evolving. And that's exactly what we're seeing in the research, which has been really interesting.
You said earlier that the experience of queer users, but also some queer like businesses that help create this sex tech, have that sort of curiosity more so than the optimization. But there is still, I remember seeing a bit of the presentation on some of the findings more recently on the industry's focus on optimization. You mentioned that it was a heteronormative thing, but is it sort of a not queer and business oriented thing? I guess, where does that, how do you justify, what do you think about that difference and why that's there, I suppose, between queer?
Yeah, you know, I think there is a tradition in health, you know, in biomedical spaces of measurable outcomes. And you are able to tell whether a product or a service is working, you know, because you evaluate it. It started at this baseline level and it's got a higher score now, therefore it's better, or the patient is better, right? So that it's a biomedical model, but it's also a kind of marketing or business model, like, you know, continuous improvement. Will we get a baseline measure and then we measure it again and then we get another measure? And people enjoy that. There is an insertive vibrator for people with vaginas called the Lioness. And one of the things it promises is it has a sense and it will give you it will give you feedback on the waveforms generated by your vaginal contractions. And you can map that over time and kind of do self-tracking, and you can do a diary element like, oh, I was a bit pissed and it took me longer, or I came harder because I was using this drug, or I wasn't as aroused because I'm on SSRIs
like
now, or that kind of thing.
And people use it. Fitbit almost.
So it's like a self-tracking device, and people like that. People like having that data around themselves. It's like a sex Fitbit, you know. And so I'm not saying, oh, this is bad. It's just that it was interesting to us when so much of the conversation about health and so much of the conversation around pleasure too in the tech space is about making things better. A lot of our participants were about like making things interesting or different or about exploration.
I guess on that point of difference, that you know, curiosity as well, do you think there are potential opportunities for the industry to capitalize on users' pleasure to come from glitchy tech? There was this sort of like fascination I noticed in some of the presentation or some of the findings around using things not for their intended purpose and getting kind of a kick out of that. I appreciate there is a safety kind of concern here, but do you think that that's potentially a gap in the market, I suppose?
Yeah, it's interesting because sex tech is, commercial sex tech is quite expensive. So, you know, even a very basic Wi-Fi enabled vibe is in the hundreds of dollars. That Lioness toy that I mentioned would probably be around $400 Australian now at the current exchange rate. So I think some of the glitchy tech that people talked about it comes from like a bit of a DIY ethos. Like, we can't afford that fancy stuff, so we're going to, you know, Zara, my colleague at QUT, talks about like, oh, so we're going to sit on the washing machine during spin cycle and see what that does for us. You know, that's a kind of lo-fi sex tech, put a condom over an electric toothbrush and see what we can do with that. So it's part of it's financial. But I think also there's a sense in which people liked the surprise elements of some kinds of sex tech. So there is a vibe you can get, or a Wi-Fi vibe that can synchronize with music. And people really liked, you know, one of the people we interviewed talked about setting the responsive vibe, setting it up with like improvisational jazz going on in the background. So there wasn't a predictable rhythm and there weren't going to be predictable sounds, like that. There was a kind of randomness or surprise element. And some of the people, like, you know, quite a few of the people who responded to the survey were kinky people too. So they were like, oh, you know, I like this as part of kink play, where some of what I'm, you know, what I'm enjoying is, getting my boundaries pushed or not getting exactly what I expected at the beginning of the session. And like, that's part of my pleasure. That's not part of everyone's pleasure, but for those interviewees, that was part of their pleasure.
I mean, the point, and I want to kind of clarify this before I ask my next question, because the point of the research is really to better understand how queer people think about sex tech and how we can, you know, sort of advance queer folks' sexual health. This is not like a business research project, but I guess as a point of curiosity, you mentioned that sex tech can be quite expensive. That Lioness thing was $400 or so. I think when I saw that there was a response around that fascination around glitchy tech, I hadn't quite clocked that, like, oh yeah, a lot of this stuff is really expensive. I guess, why is it so expensive? And do you think that it could, there is an opportunity there for queer sex tech makers to make stuff that is more accessible financially or otherwise?
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, we did speak to a bunch of queer makers and retailers and people who were really concerned, both consumers and founders and retailers were really concerned with, you know, making safe toys, for example, like out of materials that won't shed in your body or harm
your
body.
There's a durability concern there, certainly.
Yeah, yeah. And yet that were easy to clean and not going to absorb bacteria. And also, you know, who made it? Were they paid fairly? But we know, like, you know, in ethical consumption of any kind, like, nothing's perfect, but also it's very hard sometimes to get a toy at a good price point that also is paying the maker really well.
Right.
And so that was the complication for some people. Like, they were really putting together or like patchworking the experience of, you know, so the retailer was saying, we want to sell really good product. We want it to be ethically made. We want it to, you know, we're not going to buy from organizations that are transphobic or like, you know, whatever. But we understand at the same time, the community needs to afford it. And that includes like 18-year-olds who are still living at home with their parents, as well as, you know, 250-year-olds who, you know, have been shacked up for a while and have plenty of spare money to play on toys, you know, spend on toys because they don't have a mortgage anymore or that kind of thing. So, yeah, it's a tricky proposition, I think. What was interesting too from the retail perspective was the ways that people would put together kind of mix and match toy recommendations to help people get the experience that they wanted without actually saying, oh, this is the one toy that rules them all. This is the toy that will do everything you want. So there was a lot of where I think the queer ethos was really coming out was in the education and information. So it's like, oh, you want the, like, you've just had bottom surgery and you're trying to do this and that. And yet, yeah, there's not a toy exactly for you. But what I reckon is if you get this one and this one, and you kind of hack them together, then you'll get the experience that you want. And that's where I thought there was a real, that's where the kind of glitchiness or you know, the improvisational quality came out in designing and selling products was like, oh, okay, let's think about your body and what works for you, not what can be manufactured at scale for markets all over the world, because this is about you and your unique body.
The last remark that I think kind of stood out to me was around post-humanism. And given you're in this the School of Humanities and Communication at Swinburne, I won't let you go too far down that rabbit hole because I know that's someone who went to comms at Swinburne. There's that interest in fantasy sex tech, dragon's eggs, tentacles. Like, I guess, could this potentially be that interest, could that be as a result of the survey group's bias, I guess, coming from people that maybe are sexually, like sexual health more literate or digitally more literate? Do you think that maybe that fascination isn't quite representative of queer folk broadly?
Yeah, I think, I mean, there were a lot of reasons why people liked a non-representative toy. And I think I am the more social sciencey person on our team, and I think I'm a bit more down to earth on that. It's like some people in the study wanted a toy that didn't look like a sex toy, because if it was on, like, that's a, you know, one girl was 19 and lived at home with her folks. She's like, if my parents come in and I haven't put my toys away, like, I don't want a big dong on the bedside table. Like, you know, I want something a bit more plausibly ignorable. And same like with people with kids, or, you know, those guys. So some people who wanted a non-humanistic toy was like, oh, it might be out when the babysitter's over and I don't want to stress about it, you know. Some people were gamers and kind of nerds, and that's where you say it's a distinct bunch of people. Like, yeah. Some people were very tech nerdy, not just sex nerdy, but tech nerdy. So there was one person who was a gamer, and they were gender fluid themselves, and they like to play with their gender presentation. And so they also like toys that like allowed them to experience different elements of gender sexually and in contact with others, like through a gaming interface or through a VR. So they, you know, they had a fucking machine that they programmed themselves and see, yeah, not many people are going to be able to do that, but that's like a, you know, that's like the perfect storm of sex nerd and tech nerd, but it gives you a sense of what some people are kind of aspiring to in this place and what they can play with. Some people are were also very down to earth, and it's like, I want a toy. Like if I'm getting prostate toy, I want a toy that gets me off. I don't want it to run out of, to disconnect from my Wi-Fi at the wrong moment. I don't want it to run out of steam. I don't, you know, I want a toy that does the job I want it to do, and I just want a toy that gets me off. And, you know, some people were quite happy to, you know, I was talking about all that ethical toy buying. Some people were like, oh, I just want to buy a toy from Alibaba that, you know, does the job. Yeah. Like they were not fussed at all.
I guess with all of this in mind, we've spoke a little bit about people's personal experiences, I think some of the business experiences, but and this potentially might be a little bit early in the research project to ask this as well. What implications could there be in the realm of policy work to follow this project? I think especially with some of I've had a lot of conversations recently around sexual health is not, especially in the light of the Women's Health Conference that Thorn Harbor did late last year, sexual health is not just the absence of STIs. There is this sexual agency, I suppose, about it. How do you feel this research could play into policy implications down the track?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of implications around the relationships between bodily autonomy and health. So particularly for trans people and gender diverse people, toys and access to tech is part of their experience of affirming their gender, and giving pleasure to another person is really important in a way that affirms their gender and gives them gender euphoria is really important to them. So that there were people in our study who had disabilities, or their partner or partners, plural, had different kinds of disabilities where sex tech was not just a cute little add-on. It was a really important functional part of their sexuality, because it allowed their bodies to do what a person without a disability can kind of take for granted about, like, having pleasure for themselves and pleasure for their partners and having consistent pleasure that's not painful and doesn't cause cramps and, you know, all of those things. And people with diverse body sizes. So, people who were fat or people who might be older or have mobility issues, like, again, for them, having sex toys or, you know, I guess, you know, things like strap-on harnesses that are technologies, you know, that fit their body and was comfortable for their body, allowed them to be sexual in a space where they might not have as much energy, or they might, they might feel excluded in other ways because their bodies didn't conform to a very mainstream idea of how big a body should be or how firm a body should be, or, you know, all of those kinds of things. So that's where I would say sex tech comes into it in a kind of rights and justice way. And there are also issues about, you know, data justice too, which we haven't really gone into here, but, you know, where a toy connects to the internet, it is kind of leaving a data trail. It's not well regulated in Australia. That space is not well regulated in Australia. And where it is regulated, it's a kind of conservative, like, we regulate this so it won't offend, or it's a kind of, we want to, you know, maybe get a credit card record of all the users so that it can't be used for sexual violence, you know, and it's obviously a kind of preventative approach. A violence prevention approach is really important in this space, but there's also a kind of
is there an
human rights,
of security,
you know,
and
access
safety?
To pleasure, is important. You know, that and so people shouldn't have to sign their data rights away to have access to pleasure. I would say that was a long rambly.
No. But there are so many aspects to it. I suppose the project I said at the top was, I'm not sure I did actually. It's a 3-year project. I believe you are about 2 years in now. Are you still, I suppose, taking survey participants, or if not, when can people expect to potentially see some of the findings?
Yeah, we are just in the process of writing papers from the initial user interviews and retailer interviews. If there are any sex tech users who would like to be interviewed, we can still do a few more. That hasn't quite finished. But in the next stage, what we want to do is run workshops so that people can come together in groups and talk about tech. And that will include people from advocacy organizations or queer health organizations, so that they can have a chance to see the research and reflect on what the research does mean in their organizational context. Because if you're a clinical service provider, what interests you about this research might be quite different from if you're like a health promotion person, or if you're a rights and advocacy person who is interested in questions of LGBTQ plus data rights, or if you're a disability advocate who's interested in, what kinds of products and services queer people have access to. And, you know, in situations, for example, like a group home where there are real barriers to queer people being able to express their sexuality, where support workers, might be helpful, or they might be really gatekeepy about queer sex. Like, these kinds of issues have different meaning, I think, in those different contexts. And so that's where we're going to take it next, is like, well, what does it mean in these specific contexts? But yeah, we will be publishing some, clear and snappy research findings in the coming months, and we'll certainly be sharing that with places like Joy and Thorn Harbour Health and other kind of public-facing platforms. We don't know exactly where yet, because it will be about partnering with organisations who can get the word out. I know Emanate may be quite interested in an article as well, so it will likely go to places like that in the first instance.
Fantastic. Professor Kath Albury from the Swinburne University of Technology, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Well, 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 supported by Thorn Harbour Health on Joy and the Community Radio Network. For more LGBTIQ plus health and wellbeing and much more, check out Thorn Harbour on social media at Thorn Harbour or via the website thornharbour.org.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.